This is Main Street. I'm Alicia Heglin-Thorpe. There's nothing like kicking back in the summer with a cold beer. Why not make it a gold medal winning brew? Atypical Brewery and Barrel Works in Minot took home gold in the experimental wood-aged beer category in the 2022 World Beer Cup competition for their gin and spruce. Ashley Thornburg visited with Nick Holwigner, co-owner and CFO, and Eric Johnson, co-owner and head brewer. Eric begins by explaining why they call it atypical.
I guess there's a multitude of reasons. The first sort of being this room that we're in has the beautiful sort of A-framed peak roof that we embellished a little bit to really make the A stand out. On top of that, we like to make sort of out of the ordinary beers using unique ingredients or processes or both. Not everything's crazy, but a lot of the stuff we do is fun and unique.
Well, when you say unique ingredients, one of these in particular has gotten quite a big honor. Let's talk about you won a gold medal in brewing.
Yeah, so it was the first week of May. It was in Minneapolis. It travels around from year to year, the World Beer Cup. And it's sort of referred to as the Olympics of beer. They only host it every 2 years. And then, of course, thanks to COVID, it had actually been 4 years since they hosted the last one. And so, yeah, it was actually the largest competition that they've had to date. It was over 10,500 entries. And then those are split across 100 categories. Roughly 100 categories. But yeah, in one of those categories, the experimental wood-aged beer, our gin and spruce beer received a gold medal.
Can we try it?
Yeah,
let's try it.
Absolutely.
All right. So we have poured some glasses. Okay. Is this like wine? Do I, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know.
Nick's already started.
I don't know how familiar you are with sour beer, especially. So this would be a barrel-aged sour beer.
Okay.
We always suggest to people to do a three-sip rule.
Okay.
Because the acidity in the beer is going to be a bit of a shock on your palate at first. It's sour.
Mm-hmm.
And so to let your palate acclimate, you give it a sip, then do a second sip, and by about the third sip, your palate should have acclimated a little bit to the acidity, and then you'll be able to sort of dissect the flavors that are underneath that a little bit.
Okay.
That plus a little time to let the beer warm up and open up,
okay.
Then you get a bit more of flavors.
Really. Is it kind of one of those you want to coddle
the
glass?
Yeah, yeah. Your hand on the bottom of the cup will help warm it up, and then, you'll be getting a little bit more powerful flavors and essence of what the beer is as it warms up.
And it's gin and spruce. All right, here goes.
Yeah, so I guess sort of the process behind the beer is we do...
Ooh, sip number one, I like it.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, that comparing it to wine is actually a sort of a good thing that we like to do around here too, because it is sort of a transitional thing. Like, you know, wine has definitely an acidic property to it, and
mm-hmm.
so for people who are wine fans and might not know what to drink, it's kind of a good transition here
too. Yeah, it tastes very like crisp and clean.
Absolutely, we are the only brewery in North Dakota right now that does beers really like this, and so the process that we do is particularly unique. We use what are generally referred to as like wild yeast and bacteria that in a normal clean brew house could contaminate and ruin your batches of beer fairly easily.
Okay.
And so it's a danger, and most breweries want to keep those out of their facility. And so we're fortunate enough we have sort of a separate building that we can keep our barrels in that helps to minimize the risk of cross-contamination. That, and Nick and I both have biology backgrounds, so we're fairly confident in our ability to manage those cultures.
Yeah.
But, so that process will make the beer very dry and crisp, and so that's one of the appeals of doing it that way.
Yeah. Nick, what do you know about the judging process for the World Beer Cup?
Not too much, necessarily. Eric and I have both dabbled. We're guest judges. What was it called?
Hoppy Halloween.
Yeah, there's a Hoppy Halloween contest down in Fargo, and we got to be guest judges 1 year, and I was nervous the whole time being a judge. You know, it's weird to try to dissect, especially without any formal training. So I did the best I could, but I always felt strange about telling people, well, I think this is wrong, or this could have been better, and that's what they want you to do as a judge.
Okay.
So I kind of know what they're going for, but yeah, a lot of those judges are trained professionally.
Yeah.
Which I was not, so.
But how did it inform, like, your decision to enter this beer?
I don't necessarily think that being a judge informed this decision to put this beer in. What it was we just thought it was a really unique beer that came out well. We set out with the idea of the flavor profiles and you know, picking the ingredients, and it came out sort of how we envisioned, but better, you know. So we knew that it was just kind of a very unique and tasty beer, and we thought for sure this is one that we could enter.
Okay.
And there's also a little bit of knowing which category to enter it into.
Actually, sort of in a way that plays into how Nick and I got partnered up was I did a lot of homebrew competitions as a homebrewer, and some of those beers were fairly successful, and that was sort of how Nick ended up approaching me with this idea of starting Atypical together. So the judging process, for example, in this one, I think there was judges from like 28 countries. There's 220-something judges. They range from professional brewers with, you know, decades of experience in the industry to, you know, there are the equivalent of sommeliers in the beer world. They call it a Cicerone that has various levels of achievement. There's also a BJCP certification program, they call it, the Beer Judge Certification Program, which I've done portions of it. I did the written portion. The tasting portion doesn't ever really come around here, so I never got a chance to, like, finish it. But, yeah, it's pretty rigorous. So, like, some of them, to become a Grandmaster Judge, which I know a few from Fargo, you have to have judged, like, literally thousands of contests. So they really know what they're doing.
I mean, and do they do that thing where, like, you're blindfolded and you're not allowed to know anything
about
the
beer? Yeah, it's a fully blind judging. Someone else pours the beer, and then it comes with, like, a barcode and a categorized number. They know absolutely nothing about it. And actually, the judging is so rigorous, they don't necessarily award medals in every category. So, for example, the wit beer category this year, they only awarded a bronze. They didn't even give a silver or gold. So, you know, when you do, that brings a little bit more.
So it's like how many points you get, kind of a thing. It's not just this one is the best, this one is the second and third best.
Yeah. So the criteria is it an exemplary beer of that style?
Okay.
Is it what they call what would be a world class beer, and maybe it's close but not quite, and so they thought maybe just a bronze. I'm not sure what goes into decisions like that, but I do know that it sort of does bring quite a bit of prestige to the awards that are given out then too.
Wow, that's amazing. What's in the Gin and Spruce beer?
So Gin and Spruce is our golden sour base. So we have either amber base or golden base. So it's our golden base, and then after the beer was aged and soured, we got some gin barrels from Proof Distillery in Fargo.
Okay.
And aged the beer for an additional, I think, 9 months in the gin barrels, and then 6 weeks on spruce tips, juniper berries, and lime zest. Something that was kind of personally fun for me is my daughter actually, we foraged the spruce tips. And so, like, my daughter literally helped put this beer together, you know, even though it's alcohol, like, she picked those spruce tips.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of a special thing for us, too.
Yeah, and you can make a kombucha version with her.
Yeah.
So, Nick, there are three beers in front of us and three different glasses. Tell us how the different glass impacts the experience of drinking a beer.
Well, Eric, again, might be a little better on that front.
Should I only talk to you about finances?
Yeah.
Okay.
CFO.
Okay.
No, I mean, I understand some glasses hold aroma better. Some glasses warm up faster. Some glasses, you know, they do different things.
All right. We'll come back to Eric on that one. How's business going?
Business is good.
Yeah?
We're kind of a fair weather brewery because of a large amount of patio space.
Yeah.
And our outdoor events are what we strive to do and have fun with in the warmer months.
Okay.
In the winter, it's a little bit slower, but...
Yeah. Okay. Well, because I'm walking in, and first of all, I just want to say that this looks every bit like a Swiss chalet ski house. Like, it's a beautiful building. And then they walk in, and there are these gorgeous arches, and then high vaulted ceilings. But I'm in a fairly small space, which I heard is the original size of this bar. And then it has, what, double, tripled in size?
Probably tripled with the other space that we built out.
In how many years?
So we started this small first tap room took us about a year to get done.
Okay.
And
this is like a
meantime,
10 by 40 room, maybe? I mean, this
30,
is 10 by 30. Like, this is not a big room.
Pretty small.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd have it packed right away as soon as we opened the doors. I mean, elbow room only.
Yeah.
You know, people
which
yelling,
is like 12 people.
One. Yeah. It was great. It was fun. We had a lot of fun with it. We started out with only distribution before we even had this room done. And then we moved and opened this room and had a little seating area. And people could come in for beers finally. And that worked out. But very quickly we knew we needed to get in gear and get the bigger space.
Hmm. Yeah. And that was how many years?
So we did this for about a year, started working on that in another 8 months before.
Part of it was a forced break from COVID. Like, as a matter of fact, in some ways it was kind of fortuitous. Like, we had secured our financing for the expansion, like, weeks before COVID arrived in the United States. And so as that sort of ramped up, you know, obviously it made us really nervous as a business owner in the bar and restaurant industry. However, when the shutdown came, it forced us to just focus on getting the construction done on the new space. And that also helped allow us to keep some of our employees working, you know, just doing various things that weren't necessarily what they were doing before, but it was something to get through. So,
wow. Okay. Let's talk about I'm going to go back to the beer glass question since I don't want to forget it. So, elaborate for us. How does the shape of a glass impact the experience of drinking a beer?
So probably the biggest part of it is going to be how it captures the aroma. You know, you have far more smell receptors than taste receptors, and they're far more complex.
Okay.
You know, like you have your five basic tastes.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, there's thousands upon thousands of smells that people can discern. And so that's a really big part of it. And so a lot of times, you know, you'll see people swirl their glass. But in both wine and beer, that releases some of those aroma compounds. In beer, you have the added bonus of having carbonation help push that aroma out of the glass. And Nick did say, you know, another would be, you know, how quickly it warms up or doesn't. If you wanted to warm it up, you could really cup it and expose most of your hand to it, warm it up quickly. And a lot of tradition, too. Sometimes you can get into etched glassware where they are putting etching on the bottom of the glass to purposely release carbonation over time to keep
I think Duvel does that, and makes a little D shape, right?
Yep. Yeah. So you can get pretty specific with it. We do have for our Hefeweizen.
I thought that was just for fun.
Yeah. Another one for our Hefeweizen, we have a spiraled vase glass, and the spiral in the glass, as you're bringing it up and back down to your lips, will swirl around and stir up the foam and the aroma and all of that, too, as you're drinking. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of, I guess, science that goes into it, but there's looks, too, right? So different glasses will display the beer in different ways, too. So that all goes into the experience of drinking the beer.
Yeah. How did you get into brewing?
Well, actually, from sour beer. So I've been brewing personally for probably about 8 years, probably between 8 and 9. But yeah, I got exposed to sour beer at one point, and it just knocked my socks off. And I thought, this is what I want to have all the time. But at that time, it was really hard to come by. It's truly seeing a boom right now, sour beer. And so, like I said, 8, 9, 10 years ago when I was getting into it.
He skipped a step, though, because usually you would get good at brewing, normal, clean beers and then move to souring.
Oh,
but
this is
just
like more
decided to go
advanced?
Straight away to the sour beers.
Okay.
I sort of learned that maybe that wasn't the way. So, over time I did end up sort of focusing on doing the regular styles first and then moving on to sour stuff. I've kind of been given the honorific by the homebrew community and some of the Minot beer community of Eric the Sour, they call me, because everyone knows that's just I love it, and that's my passion. And
it's a nice Viking name.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Totally. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It, like.
Yeah. I definitely fit the part for the for having a Viking name.
Well, you used to teach high school, right?
I did. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
That didn't actually have anything to do with getting into brewing, believe it or not. But
that would make me want to drink.
It was just. I wanted to have it available at all times, and it was hard to find, and when you could find it, it was fairly expensive, and so I decided I was going to learn how to do it, and I guess I did a fairly good job at it.
A gold medal, good job. Nick, how about you? Same question. How'd you get into this? And I know you're more on the finance end.
Well, so I started in just interested.
Yeah.
Like, got a brew kit in college. And tried it, and it turned out and tasted like crap. undrinkable, poured it down the drain. And then a few years later, two of my friends decided to do a batch or two. And I was, again, reinterested because theirs was turning out pretty decent.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we did a batch together and maybe a couple more after that. And pretty soon they weren't available to keep doing batches, whereas I was like, okay, now I need all the equipment, keep upgrading. And then, yeah, I just started doing it on my own in the kitchen, and eventually it turned out pretty decent.
Yeah.
Just kind of caught the bug and went from there.
And you have a biology background?
I do, yes.
Okay. How does that impact, the ability to make beer?
For me, more
chemistry, but I don't know.
For me, it just helped me understand the processes.
Okay.
I knew what was happening with the yeast, with fermentation and all that. So it was still amazing to get the end product, visually watch it. You have those glass carboys that are sitting in your basement that are just bubbling like crazy, and you're thinking to yourself, holy crap, this is alive. This is creating something that I'm going to, be able to enjoy. So it caught me that way.
I always get like, this starts with a plant, and pollen, and just like, what? Mm-hmm. How did it get to this?
Yeah. It's kind of like how gardeners, you know, they catch the bug and and then they're just too interested to stop.
Yeah. I want to talk about the role of community in a brewery, because I'm looking at your sign here. You're having yoga and massages. We've already talked about the patio. There is clearly local art everywhere. I understand one of the owners did a lot of the building. So can you just talk about the role of community in a brewery versus, you know, just drinking?
Yeah, you know, I do think that's, you probably nailed it, and that is one of the, I would say, defining differences. And so for Atypical, I mean, we do literally as much as we can. You touched on a lot. So to start, Brady Dixon of Bad Creations just did a fantastic job. He is one of our partners. And yeah, he did the construction, but it's not construction, it's art. He made this place look like, so the building is from the 1920s.
Okay.
And he really made it look as original as he possibly could, and we do use several local artists to do our labels. We collaborate with various nonprofits, or, you know, we will donate to various causes. For example, currently on tap, we partnered up with the Midwest Murder Podcast, and they came up with the idea to do a raspberry lemon sour beer, and then a portion of the proceeds are going to the Domestic Violence Crisis Center for that. Mm. So we do a lot of partnerships like that. We recently just hosted a 5K and Wiener Dog Derby and Beer Mile Run, partnered with Run with Heart and Soul. And so, yeah, we're just doing stuff year-round to get both other parts of the community involved, get people out. You know, we always have live music, food trucks. I really, especially in the summer when we do have our big patio open, I look at it as a gathering space for the community. We just had our anniversary party last weekend. When we have big events like that and goings-on and food trucks, we always try to get a special event permit so we can allow all ages. So families can come down and have a good time as long as they're not coming inside the actual building.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're really pushing to be a gathering space and a community building space.
How do you describe the brewery community in Minot and then maybe across the state?
In general,
yeah.
I would just say most of the breweries that we come in contact with or know and have gotten to know, they're very open. They like to share information. In fact, we've done a number of collaborations with different breweries from around the state. Our most recent was Fargo Brewing. We did a collaboration with them called A-Team, and it was a cold IPA. And they got a hold of us, and they're like, this turned out really good. And we're like, yeah, we think so, too. Because we brewed it at both places, did a batch at their place, and then they came down, and we did a batch here. And we were kind of wondering how it was going over. But on both ends, people were really enjoying it. And, yeah, I mean, again, they called it A-Team. You know, it was a team effort,
yeah,
and it turned out really well.
I have yet to talk to anybody who owns a brewery who feels like they're in competition with a different brewery.
Right, right.
Yeah, just to add on to that, Nick went down to Fargo, and they brewed a batch down there. So we brewed the same recipe a week later. They came here, and they taught us a totally new technique that I had no idea what it was. It's called hop dipping, which is kind of a...
Ooh, sounds fun.
Yeah. But, yeah, I had no idea what it was, and they were more than willing and happy to share that information, and we've now used it a few times to pretty good success. So, yeah, pretty much through and through, the brewing community is usually pretty open and rising tide lifts all boats sort of attitude.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Ashley Thornburg with Nick Holwigner and Eric Johnson of Atypical Brewery and Barrel Works in Minot. Coming up after the news, Minot artist Sarah Pinier designs Atypical's beer labels. She visits with Ashley Thornburg about her multifaceted art career, including work related to national parks. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Calling it devastating, the North Dakota State Director of Planned Parenthood says today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling to overturn Roe v. Wade opens up a door that 50 years of precedence doesn't matter.
When, some of our Supreme Court justices were going through the nomination process, we heard over and over again, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. And so we just kind of crossed our fingers and we're like, okay, you said this was the law of the land. But here we are now, June of 2022, and all of a sudden Roe v. Wade is not law of the land.
Tammy Krummenacher is owner and clinic director of the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo. She says she will relocate to Moorhead, where abortion will remain legal. Planned Parenthood has a clinic in Moorhead, but it does not provide abortions at that location. This week, the state health department confirmed 1,222 new cases of COVID-19 statewide. This averages out to just under 175 new cases per day. The department's coronavirus dashboard lists North Dakota's seven-day case rate per 100,000 people as 160. 254 new cases were confirmed in Cass County, 166 in Burley County, and 99 in Grand Forks County. A detailed map of all cases from each county is posted on our news page at news.prairiepublic.org. In the last 7 days, 50 new patients were admitted to area hospitals with COVID-19. As of today, 53 inpatient beds and 3 ICU beds are currently occupied with COVID patients. And damaging winds, large hail, and the possibility of a tornado or two are all expected this afternoon and into the evening and overnight hours in eastern North Dakota. Jacob Spender is a forecaster with the National Weather Service in Grand Forks. He says there is a lot of unstable air across the northern plains, and as clusters of storms form across North Dakota and Minnesota, they will become more organized as the day wears on. Spender says these variables add up to a very active day across the area.
So early on in the event, we're looking at that hail up to 2 inches, looking at the damaging wind threat up to 70 to 75 miles per hour, and the potential for a couple tornadoes as well. Localized flooding will also be an issue across the area. And then by the late afternoon to the early evening, then we're looking at a damaging wind threat and an isolated tornado threat with winds up to 80 and the potential for some isolated tornadoes, and then up to an inch and a half hail.
These impacts may be seen across eastern North Dakota and northwestern Minnesota. Spender says residents should monitor weather reports, have a way to receive emergency warnings this afternoon and evening, and have a plan to be able to take sturdy shelter in place. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the recipients of the 2022 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2022 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows. And by Otto Bremer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremer.org.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Alicia Heglin-Thorpe. It takes a village. They say that about raising kids, but it's true about building community. Minot artist and freelance illustrator Sarah Pinier is busy with screen printing, posters, and beer labels. She visits with Ashley Thornburg at Atypical Brewery in Minot, where she has a National Parks poster exhibit on display.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
So I came across your name. I've come across your name actually a couple of times on different visits to Minot, but most recently where we are sitting right now, which is at Atypical Brewing, and found out that you did a lot or maybe even all of the labels for
most of
the labels for their beers. And then you have an incredible body of work on the walls. So I really just want to start with saying, do you have any idea how good of an artist you are?
No idea, none whatsoever. Maybe a little bit.
This body of work that I'm referring to is on the walls of Atypical, and it is a set of posters of screen printing, and please correct me when I get the words wrong here, of national park inspired pieces. And then there is also a theme that has a lot of aliens. They are incredibly detailed. The colors are just rich and beautiful. I guess I'll start with just, have you always been out to make things more beautiful?
First of all, absolutely. Everything is always meant to be more beautiful. What I will say about this exhibition in particular is that I actually just completed my artist in residency position at Minot State University. And so the work that's on Atypical's walls right now is the work that I had up at my exhibition for my conclusion of my residency. So okay. It's all of the work that I've been doing in the last year. And I brought it over to Atypical so that I could bring together all of the elements of the work that I've been doing in the last year, but also to have my work up while we were also celebrating my label designs for Atypical. And so some of the work is pen and ink drawing, mm-hmm. where it's micron pen on paper. Some of it is digital illustrations, such as the Alien series that you were just talking about. So they are digital prints of stuff that I drew on my iPad. And then I have some of the National Park-inspired stuff, which is a completely different project entirely.
Well, weave us a golden thread here. What ties those two projects that you would want to display them together?
Right. So the reason that I'm displaying all of this work together was because of this residency, I wanted to show the people of Minot, my professors, the students of MSU, I guess all of the community members, the stuff that I've been doing over the past year. Mm-hmm. I can be kind of a sporadic artist, so I'm constantly working in different areas. So I'll be doing commercial projects as well as personal projects. And so I wanted to exhibit everything together so that people kind of had a look into my life as an, you know, a professional illustrator, the crazy paths that everything takes you on.
Do you want to give us an example? What do you mean when you say crazy path?
The crazy path is when you're a freelance illustrator, such as what I'm doing, I'm not working for an organization in particular solely. And so my work, because I would like to work for myself, because I would like to take on the commissioned work that is the most meaningful for me, I get that work from a lot of different places. And so one facet is a company that I work for. I design t-shirts for national parks. So that's where the National Park-inspired posters come from. The alien work is my own personal work. Mm-hmm. So that was my tribute to my personal quirky, funky artwork. but then I also do other work for Atypical, doing label design. I also work for other local organizations like the Blue Rider of Minot, a bar, and then also Prairie Sky Breads of Minot, which is a coffee house / bakery.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Yeah, so, you know, kind of similar to branding, there is this idea that when an artist is representing a company and what they stand for, you have to really understand, like, the ethics and the values and the community and whatever is the inspiration behind the people doing the thing that... want you to make the art for it. So what is your process for understanding how someone else is thinking and then align that with just sort of your own values as an artist?
So when I'm doing work for the community of Minot, I think part of it is that I am making work for the organizations that I feel most passionate about, that I think that their branding, but also just their environment in general is very conducive to the type of art, but also business that I really love. So in the case of the Blue Rider, Prairie Sky Bread, and Atypical. They are all three organizations that are very passionate about local music. They're very passionate about the community in general, and they're passionate about being fun, whimsical, lighthearted, and just generally excited about life. And so I think in that way, the style of art that I make has both enabled me to be able to work in the way that I already work, but also made it a lot easier for me to adapt my style to the way that they want their graphics to look. So in the case of Prairie Sky Bread, they wanted what they call scone trolls, but they are inspired by...
I don't know what those are, but I love this phrase.
Yeah. So with the scone trolls, so in Scandinavian heritage, trolls are a large part of some of their aesthetics. So you'll see them all over events like the Hostfest, which happens in Minot. So I have designed people who... One person works at Prairie Sky. The other person is a regular customer of Prairie Sky, but I designed trolls to look like those people. But they gave me complete creative freedom to do what I like.
Yeah.
And so I was able to easily adapt my style to their style. And the same has happened with Atypical and the Blue Rider. I've been given a lot of freedom by these organizations.
I want to talk about that word freedom and what it means to an artist, because it's not always a given that you get to have your own voice, even though you're hired to do something. So can you talk about just the importance of staying true to yourself while still representing somebody else's business?
Absolutely. So I grew up in Minot. I have witnessed the atmosphere and sort of the changes that this community has experienced. I've also worked in local restaurants and businesses since I was 14. And so because of that, I feel like I have, you know, first of all, spent the time in these places to start to understand what they stand for, why they stand for it, and what that is. But the other part is, you know, when it comes to freedom of design, I think that because I have spent so much time in this community, I have gotten to know the owners and people who work at these businesses well enough to establish a relationship. They have seen my work. They have seen my work from its infancy at a young age, you know, maybe 15 or 16, and then kind of grown with me. And so, you know, because I am a determined, hardworking person, they have seen that work grow, and they can trust me to make the artwork that I do now, which I know is an extremely privileged position, but I could not be more thankful and excited to keep getting to work with these businesses. They are familiar with my work. I am familiar with them. I know what their attitudes are. I know what they need, and I can make that work accordingly.
Let's talk about these beer labels that are sitting in front of us, because there are so many different, even just the fonts that represent the different beers. How many fonts do you know?
A lot of these are either my own font.
Okay.
Or they're an adaptation of the font that Atypical uses. There's one in particular that is derivative of the musical artist that the label was based off of.
Okay.
But for the most part, they are my own penmanship.
Wow.
So for the most part.
So you are designing fonts here.
I wouldn't necessarily say I'm designing fonts, but I did do the lettering. Because I always feel the most confident with my illustration style if the text is also in my own hand, because I feel like it speaks to the artwork more. And I have experience in, I mean, in the, so one label in particular is, the title of the beer is called Edith. It's a farmhouse table beer that Atypical just released about June 3rd.
Yeah, what is it about the word Edith that screams script and lovely, thoughtful handwriting.
So the dog that the label was based, so the name Edith is actually based off of a Pomeranian owned by one of the employees of Atypical, and she is this tiny, cute baby Pomeranian, and it's a farmhouse table beer. And so a farmhouse table beer is a very low ABV beer. It's a light, easy drinking beer, and I wanted it to be a script because I wanted it to be symbolic of the light, effervescent nature of the beer. Each beer is its own unique thing. While a lot of their bottled beer are sours, I still try to take the ingredients that they're using for their beers, the processes that they're using to develop these beers, but also their inspiration into consideration when I am describing these visual elements. I want the label to describe the atmosphere, the culture, and the ingredients that are in the beer.
Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
That's Ashley Thornburg visiting with Minot artist Sarah Pinier. Up next, Matt Olien with a movie review that takes us to infinity and beyond.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The 17-year-old violinist on this week's From the Top performs the music of Clara Schumann with remarkable sensitivity. I'm Peter Dugan. Join me to meet her on this week's From the Top.
Sunday at 9 a.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
All right, you know what time that is. It's time for a movie review with Matt Olien. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Alicia.
So today you're giving us a review on Lightyear, a movie about Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, so this is Pixar's new film, Lightyear. You know, obviously a spinoff of the Toy Story franchise, but very different because it tells you right at the beginning of the film what you're watching is what Andy watched in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're kind of in Andy's world, who, of course, if people don't remember, is the little boy who has Woody and Buzz as his toys. And so he goes to see the movie. We don't see Andy. He goes to see the movie about Buzz Lightyear that prompts the product of Buzz Lightyear action figure being made. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's the spinoff. So what we're seeing
is... Or a sidequel.
Yeah, I love that word. So, yeah, it's about Buzz being a space ranger and his friend Izzy, played by Kiki Palmer. Chris Evans voices Buzz Lightyear, not Tim Allen. So we have Chris Evans now from Captain America fame. And I would say I like this film well enough. I liked it better than I thought I would, actually. The box office has been very disappointing. It made about $52 million the first weekend. That's low for a Pixar movie.
Yeah.
Not quite sure what the optics are telling us, like why that is the case. I'm not sure if it doesn't have enough to do with Toy Story. I'm not sure. But at any rate, I liked it well enough. It's not a masterpiece like Toy Story 1 or Toy Story 3 are, but I liked it well enough, and it's essentially a science fiction adventure film. He and Kiki Palmer, who plays Izzy Hawthorne, his fellow space ranger, get stranded on a hostile planet, and they try to get off. And he tries to get off and find a way through kind of a next dimension, time dilation. And through all of these time dilations, it reminded me of a Christopher Nolan film, you know, Tenet, Inception, these kind of things. So that kind of plot point I thought was quite interesting and a little bit different for an animated film, a little more of an adult plot point, you know, time bending, things like this. And you'll have to go see the movie to see what exactly happens when Buzz returns from these hyperspace journeys he goes on to try to get them off the planet, and then he returns, and what happens there is very interesting. I thought that was the best part of the plot, actually, is what happens to the people on the hostile planet when he returns. So there's time-bending things going on like that. Overall, I did like it. I think that the characterizations were good. Sox, the robot cat, kind of steals the movie, kind of this new character. He's like a side companion to Buzz. At first, he's not liking that he has a robot cat, but eventually they bond, and this Sox the Cat becomes a real lifesaver in the movie, who's also funny and interesting and very affectionate as well. And we see Buzz having to train a group of ragtag Space Ranger volunteers who basically are not terribly helpful to him at first. So that's the plot in general. You know, they need to get off this hostile planet. And, you know, it's a solid movie. It's not an animated masterpiece, I would say. But I did read an interview with the director, Angus MacLean. He said he wanted to make this more realistic in terms of, like, the sci-fi films he saw as a kid and to make it, quote, more chunky. So I think his view is to try to make this movie like you're watching a science fiction movie with real people, except they're animated.
That's really neat. So do you think that this movie really takes viewers to infinity and beyond?
Yeah, I would say in general. I liked it better than I thought I would. You know, the critics have been a little bit divided on this. And again, like I said, Alicia, I'm not sure why it's underperformed at the box office, especially compared to Jurassic World and Top Gun, which just have done gangbusters at the box office. You know, my theory, too, is there's so much animated content out there right now on streaming services that I wonder if it's just got to be something incredible to really hit the box office the way the Toy Story films did, or Up, or something like that.
I've been reading that some viewers or potential viewers aren't going to see it because they are really, really big Tim Allen fans. And for Tim Allen to not be a part of this movie since he was the character, why do you think he wasn't allowed or even asked to be in this movie when he is such an iconic voice of Buzz Lightyear?
I haven't really researched that as to why Chris Evans ended up in this movie or Tim Allen did not want to do the movie. I'm not really sure because, yeah, it's so closely identified with Tim Allen, but Chris Evans is fine as Buzz. I don't think that diminishes the movie at all. It's a very conventional animated film in terms of Pixar, very likable. So I don't know. It's very interesting. You know, box office is something I really follow very closely, and it's always interesting to see why something captures the zeitgeist and why something doesn't.
Right.
And this goes back years and years to when they started tracking box office receipts in the 20s and 30s, and, you know, why Gone with the Wind was the biggest movie ever, inflation adjusted, and why there are flops, you know, that come along. So not really sure why this is underperforming. I don't quite get it. I think by industry standards, they were expecting about a $90 million opening weekend, and it was about 57, I think, something like that.
Well, perhaps it'll pick up here in the next couple of weekends. You never know.
We'll
right?
see. Usually films diminish their second weekend, and then word of mouth. Now, word of mouth has made Top Gun Maverick, stellar.
Right.
But I'm not sure word of mouth is going to be strong enough to push people to Lightyear, even though it's a solid film.
So Pixar, of course, known for their successful animations and award-winning movies. So they won 11 awards total so far. Can you name at least three Pixar movies that have won Best Animated Feature?
Yes. Toy Story 3, one animated feature, Up, and Ratatouille.
Yes.
There's many more, too.
Many
like
more.
Wall-E, yep.
Incredibles, Finding Nemo, Inside Out, Soul. A lot of those. And Coco.
Zootopia is great, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Well, thank you so much for your insight on the movie Lightyear, Matt.
Okay, thanks, Alicia.
And we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Hornbacher's Foods, committed to a strong community while proudly serving families. Hornbacher's, freshness and quality since 1951.
So I was inquiring about the word Dutchman. My understanding of a Dutchman is that it is a patch of a much higher level than just a spackle it over kind of thing.
I could eat this with one foot in the milk bucket.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
You know, he's really not all that in a bag of chips.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 24th. In recent years, we've grown increasingly aware of green terms, reducing carbon footprints and improving energy efficiency, to the point where many of these environmentally friendly terms have been added to the dictionary. but progress and energy efficiency have been goals longer than that. On this date in 1953, the city of Stanley had just approved funding for a system of mercury vapor streetlights, and within a few days had issued calls for construction bids. The cost was to be covered by levies on the property where the new lighting would be placed, with 20% of the cost covered by city funds. Plans for the new system consisted of 29 mercury lights, with 12 along the business section on steel poles and 17 on wooden poles, from the underpass to the school. It was expected that the project would give Stanley a much brighter, more efficient lighting than the old incandescent lamps. The mercury lamp was the first type of mass-produced metal vapor lighting for general applications. These lamps had a relatively long life and were fairly easy to maintain with a low system cost. With a nice white light, they were perhaps the perfect value back then, and they continued to be used across the world for decades. Installing the new system was a big step, and although initially expensive, it would save money in the long run, as the old incandescent bulbs were less efficient and cost twice as much. The mercury lamps had already been installed in Williston, Kenmare, and Crosby, and plans were also underway in Newtown. You won't see these lamps installed today. Due to environmental concerns about mercury, the 2005 Energy Policy Act called for the manufacture and importation of mercury vapor lamps to be phased out by 2008. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association, here for you, and the 15,000 people in North Dakota living with Alzheimer's, providing support groups, family care consultations, community classes, and a 24/7 helpline. Learn more at alz.org.
On the next Radiolab.
It's like a low-stakes Y2K.
A story about folks that don't exist.
William, no last name.
Busy zero.
You know, doctor undefined.
And the computers that delete them.
Oh, my God.
The whole screen would go gray.
It's just an avalanche.
And then freeze.
Fundamental difference between the way humans process information and the way computers process information.
That's on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
That's all for today's show. Monday on Main Street, UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein will be here for Philosophical Currents when we discuss what does it mean to be conservative or liberal. Then we travel to Antler, North Dakota, where the town's newly formed historical society is working to restore one of the last original town square buildings in the state. That's Monday on Main Street. Join us at 3 and 7 Central. I'm Alicia Heglin-Thorpe. Thanks for listening.